Hello everyone. Today I would like to welcome Daniel Erickson to the show. Daniel is a leading sleep coach and author who's been helping thousands of people around the world improve their sleep. Daniel began his career as a sleep physician, then transitioned into the role of sleep coach. He will later explain to us the difference. He's the author of two impactful books, Set It and Forget It and This Is Natto. I have personally read these books and I can say from experience the insights in there truly work. He's also the founder of the Sleep Coach School, an online education platform that aims to change the way the world sleeps by reaching as many insomniacs as possible. In today's episode, we will explore Daniel's counterintuitive yet truly effective approach to overcoming insomnia, a topic that many of us are very much interested in. Daniel, welcome to the IJK podcast.
Thanks so much for having me and thanks for that nice introduction.
You're most welcome. Daniel, before we start diving into the exciting world of sleep, could you please explain the difference between a sleep physician and a sleep coach? And then tell us a bit about your journey. How did you make the transition from sleep physician to becoming a sleep coach?
Yeah, definitely. That's a nice place to start. So I'd say like a sleep physician is a medical doctor who has specialized in sleep medicine. And now, a doctor who's specialized in sleep medicine, so a sleep doctor, essentially you can think of as an expert on sleep apnea. That's kind of the big disorder that sleep doctors treat, and sleep apnea is when we have trouble breathing during our sleep. And so a sleep doctor will diagnose and treat sleep apnea. Now, a sleep coach, it's not something that has like any formal recognition really, or kind of there's no formal characteristics of what exactly sleep coach is. But when I call myself a sleep coach, I think of it as I am somebody who helps people who are struggling with sleep, somebody who's like have difficulty with sleep, essentially somebody who has insomnia. I help that person through education and support and guidance. And to share a little bit of my journey, I was actually born and raised in Sweden. My dad is Danish, my mom is Ethiopian, but you know that's kind of where it all starts, right? But what I want to share is really that both my parents were in the helping field. My mom was a nurse, my mom's a doctor, so it was very natural for me to also go into medicine. Became a doctor. I moved to the States because people told me medical education was really good here. And then I had this random encounter when I was in my training here in the States. I had a good friend who said, "Hey, Daniel, do you know that there's a specialization in sleep medicine? You can become a sleep doctor." That really intrigued me. I'd never heard of anything like that. I was like, wow, that's cool. I always wanted to have like a niche, like become like an expert in a little field. So I read up on it and I thought, this is really interesting. You learn about like, the you know, it'll answer the questions of what's the purpose of sleep? Why do we sleep? And I can make a living helping people sleep. That sounds really cool to me. So I did my training at the University of Chicago. And then I graduated. And now it's time for me to like, you know, get out in the real world and help people. And I found that although my sleep medicine fellowship had been really focused, again, on sleep apnea, there were a great number of people, maybe more people, who really struggled with insomnia. And that becomes sort of the starting point for me transitioning into becoming a sleep coach. But I'll pause there for now.
Okay, cool. Just a question. Do you still recommend that people check, like rule out sleep apnea before undergoing your program, or not necessarily?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I would say, I would kind of share just my blanket disclaimer that anyone out there who is concerned about their health should talk to a doctor. So if anyone out there hears this and like, yeah, I don't know, do I have sleep apnea? Do I have a medical condition? Do I have this or that? Talk to a doctor and kind of get their blessing or get their clearance to work with us before, if you're concerned about your health. But with that said, over the years I've done sleep coaching, I can't say that I've had a single student in the sleep coach school that had sort of like misclassified themselves. Really, essentially everyone who finds us, they know that they have insomnia because they know that their struggle is based on like fear and concerns and worries. And that's what's keeping them awake at night. Sleep apnea is very different. There's no emotional component. There's just somebody who says like, I snore like crazy and I wake myself up snoring and I feel sleepy during the day, sleep apnea. Insomnia is like, you know, when we're like, what's going on with me? How is this going to affect my health and et cetera, et cetera. So it's usually for most people very easy to tell one from the other.
Oh, okay. That's helpful. Was there a particular patient or experience that made you question the conventional sleep hygiene advice that, you know, we are exposed to, all of us, most of us are exposed to this classic sleep hygiene advice, turn off the lights, make sure there's no noise, make sure that you're sleeping with the right temperature. But obviously, all this is, you know, probably doesn't work, or maybe it used to work at one point, and maybe it was not enough to get to the bottom of the problem. So what was kind of your aha moment, if I may say?
Yeah. I would say this, that when it comes to sleep hygiene, and for anyone out there in the audience who, again, doesn't know what I talk about when I say sleep hygiene, well, sleep hygiene is this laundry list of do's and don'ts that supposedly make us sleep better. And these are things like keep your bedroom calm, like cool, keep the temperature on the low side, don't have too much light there, keep the noise level low, make sure you're comfortable, don't drink coffee after 2 p.m., things of that nature. That's all sleep hygiene. And to be honest with you, I never really was a believer in sleep hygiene. I kind of intuitively sensed that this is not really what matters to people. And why I never believed in that, I can't say, but it to me was similar to how when we have a cold, you know, our grandma says like, well, make sure to have vitamin C. Another one starts like, drink this tea. And then I was like, none of that really works. We know that. And I had the same intuitive feeling about sleep hygiene. But what I did believe in when I started my practice as a sleep doctor was the kind of mainstream psychological approach to insomnia, known as cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI. And in essence, CBTI centers around building sleep drive, which is, you know, essentially trying to make you so sleepy that you'll sleep no matter what. So the idea in CBTI is that if you've had trouble sleeping, you just make sure to get up early, stay out of bed till it's really late and you're really sleepy, and only then go to bed. And then you'll be so sleepy that you sleep, right? And the other part of CBTI is the idea that we shouldn't be in bed if we're not sleeping. The idea is kind of this behavioralistic idea that if you're in bed but not sleeping, then your brain will start to think of the bed as a place where you don't sleep, and therefore you'll have trouble sleeping. So I did believe in that when I started practicing sleep medicine. And so I would tell people to, you know, limit their time in bed and not spend too much time in bed if you're not sleeping, et cetera, et cetera. And after a while, I started having some doubts about how helpful this was. And I saw a lot of patients who came back to me and said, well, what you told me seemed to work, but I don't really know how. There was kind of something missing. There was some insight missing. And there was a specific, in fact, this was not a patient. This was a follower when I started my YouTube channel, who said, hey, Daniel, I'm sleeping okay now, but I'm only sleeping about like 4 hours, and I go to bed at midnight and I get up at 6. What should I do? And I knew that the like CBTI approach would be like, okay, your sleep efficiency, which is the time that you're, the proportion of the time in bed that you're sleeping, is less than 80%. Therefore, you should spend less time in bed so that you're even sleepier and you fall asleep quickly, et cetera, et cetera. So I knew that the traditional advice to him from CBTI would be spend even less time in bed. But intuitively, it didn't make sense to me. It's like, why would that really help? Maybe a nicer approach would be to be like, well, let me focus on other things in life. Let me be like, okay, I'm only sleeping this little now, but let me do something else. And I kind of told this to him. And, you know, I remember him being like, no, I'm going to spend less time in bed. He was like the classical, like, let me kind of force this to work. But that was a moment to me when I saw that I started questioning the wisdom of traditional CBTI. That was a big moment. And another moment was, I met up with this sleep coach, let's call it. He had worked in the traditional field as well. His name is Michael Schwartz. And I asked him, like, how does he practice? And he says, well, I just kind of talk to people. And I was like, oh, you don't have them fill out a sleep diary and how recording how much time they slept and how much time they're waking up? He was like, no. And then I was like, well, how can you calculate anything? And then he was like, well, you don't need to calculate anything. And that was another moment when I'm like, oh, this whole kind of obsession with calculating and trying to predict and changing sleep windows and things of that nature, I think it just produces more anxiety. So those were kind of like big moments when things shifted for me. And I'll add one last one, then back to you. I was reading this book called Mindfulness-Based Therapy for Insomnia by Jason Ong. And in that book, he wrote something that I never forget. He wrote that the person that has insomnia is trying to escape wakefulness or trying to escape being awake. And that just resonated with me because I had essentially the same thought myself, that insomnia is more like, it's almost like a phobia where we're trying to escape not sleeping. Escape, it's like we're afraid of not sleeping. And that really, that turned into kind of this whole idea of doing the opposite of befriending wakefulness. But those are some key moments for me that led to where I am today.
Okay. Let's dive now into your core philosophy for better sleep. So you talk a lot about the paradox of sleep effort, and you just mentioned now something along these lines. So my question to you, why does trying harder to sleep tend to backfire and we end up sleeping worse in the end?
Yeah. Absolutely. Great question. And I would start here by saying that in my framework, in my philosophy, one of the most like fundamental truths is that sleep is effortless. Sleep is a passive process. It's something that just happens when we're not trying to make it happen. It's sort of like breathing or feeling or thinking. These are just processes that happen by themselves. And anyone who hears this and goes like, I'm not so sure about that. Well, I can assure you that you can actually find evidence very close to, you know, where you are. You can just think of anyone in your life who is this quote unquote good sleeper, anyone in your life who you know sleeps very easily. That may be your partner, your dad, your cousin, somebody, right? And you imagine asking them for the key. Imagine asking them, hey, how do you sleep so well? And they will share the secret with you. They will look at you a little bit confused, shrug and go like, I don't know. Which actually, like I say, like it's kind of like
gives a hint. Yeah.
But it is true. Like they will say, I don't know, which illustrates how that person who sleeps so well, they are sleeping so well because they're not trying whatsoever to sleep. It is an effortless process. Now, another way we can see evidence of this is to think of the person, you know, the other person we know who's the person that's really struggling with sleep. And we ask that person, well, what are you doing to sleep? And the classic insomnia will tell you like 27 things. They're like, well, I start a wind down routine at 6 p.m. I don't have any coffee after 5 p.m. I eat a light snack. Then I go for a run. And then I have my blackout curtains. Then I do my sleepy. And then I take a supplement. And I still don't sleep, right? So we can just see the evidence clearly just by thinking of these two archetypes, that not trying to sleep, it leads to sleeping easily. And trying to sleep leads to struggles with sleep. And it is a paradox because when you look at almost anything else in life, the opposite is true. If you want to become really good at, you know, playing the guitar, then the more you practice, the better you're going to get, right? If you want to play tennis, like the more you practice, the better you're going to get. But again, sleep is not a skill and it's not a behavior. Sleep is just a state that the mind enters into automatically when we are sleepy and when we're not trying to for sleep when there's not hyperarousal. So I think that would be my answer there.
All right, understood. And based on what you said, it looks like fear and like the willingness to control and the hyper focus on sleep is actually the problem. So is it always this? Like, is it most of the time this? Like these? I mean, is like the willingness to control one's sleep and the fear of not sleeping is always or most of the time at the core of these insomnia issues that you encounter?
I would say like the short answer to me would be yes, but to expand a little bit on that, I would say the following. Maybe the most common like pushback I get when I teach, you know, what I'm teaching you and your audience here is somebody saying like, no, Daniel, that's not true. Sometimes insomnia is because I have sleep apnea, or sometimes insomnia is because I have these hormonal things going on, or sometimes insomnia is because I have pain, etc. And then I say that it is, of course, true that there are many, many things that have an impact on our sleep. If you just, broken your jaw and you have a lot of pain from there, you are not going to sleep well because the pain is going to disrupt your sleep. If your neighbor has just installed loudspeaker system and they're throwing a party at night, you're not going to sleep well because sound is going to disrupt your sleep. If you're a woman in your 50s or 60s and you're going through menopause and you have these hormonal changes in your body and hot flashes, that's going to disrupt your sleep. But my point here is that you can come up with countless things that disrupt your sleep, but those things, that's not insomnia. That's not the same thing. In our world, in my philosophy, in our framework, we define insomnia as an ongoing self-perpetuating struggle that comes from thinking of not sleeping as a threat, you know? And so now we can answer the question in a meaningful way. We can say that, in fact, insomnia always comes from seeing not sleeping as a threat. But there's, of course, a lot of things that can disrupt your sleep that are not insomnia.
I see. And if we talk about sleep anxiety in that case, how does it differ from just general anxiety? Do you notice, for example, in your practice that usually anxious people who are anxious in their lives in general tend to be more likely like sleep anxiety sufferers and then tend to have problems with their sleep?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would say this, that I do believe that if you look at everyone who struggled with sleep, struggled with insomnia, there is probably an overrepresentation of people who have this like tendency towards worrying, tendency towards anxiety. And the person who's also a high achiever, a doer, a person who gets things done, type A personality. Yeah, yes, you tend to have more of that personality in the group of people who have insomnia. But how about like when we are not necessarily worried about sleep, we're just worried about other things in life, is that going to cause insomnia? And the answer actually goes back to the one we had before about sleep disruption versus insomnia. If you're going through something that's stressful in your life and that stress and those worries keep you awake at night, that's actually not insomnia again. That's more like sleep, like disrupted sleep from stress in our lives. And the key differentiator is that sleep disruption from stress or from anxiety about other things in your life, what you'll see is that you will just sleep easier once you're not so stressed about that, once you're not so anxious about that. It doesn't have, quote unquote, a life of its own. It's not the self-sustaining loop that insomnia is. So I think that's kind of the differentiator there.
Okay, I understood. So people, for example, who are by nature concerned too much by their health, so who have like let's call it health anxiety, if today they read an article that says, for example, you have to sleep 8 hours, otherwise, you know, you might have health problems. You know, is it possible that that person may actually develop over time insomnia, because that person will start to improve their sleep, and then inadvertently they would start, you know, going down a rabbit hole, and then actually, you know, start suffering from disrupted sleep by these worries? Is this like kind of something that is current or classic, or is it like something common?
Yeah, no, that is actually very common. And to give you a full and meaningful answer here, let us talk about the most common way that I see insomnia happen. So the most common way is that we have some type of life stressor. Something happens in our life, right? We're moving, we start college, we have a new job, we're in a relationship, but something like that happens and we're a little bit stressed and we naturally sleep less. And that happens to all of us. When we are stressed, it's essentially our brain thinking like, maybe there's a threat here, maybe we should be a little bit more alert here. And we're naturally a little bit more awake and vigilant. Completely normal and expected, happens to all of us, right? But for some who may have this kind of tendency towards worrying, tendency towards overthinking and things of that nature, they have a disruptor in their life, they're a little bit more awake, and then what happens is this idea forms that, oh, wait a minute, I'm not sleeping enough. It shouldn't be like this. I'm not sleeping enough. Maybe this is a problem. And that's kind of the moment when their brain identifies not sleeping as a threat. And what happens next now is that this person goes like, oh, wait, I didn't sleep well last night. Maybe it was just a fluke, but let's see what happens tonight, right? And that next night is the effortlessness is gone. It's not like this person goes to bed and just like assumes they'll sleep. They're kind of on the lookout. They're like, what's going to happen now? Am I going to sleep? Am I not going to sleep? What's going to happen? And because of that kind of like effortful,
hyper-focus.
Hyper-focus, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. They have another night of not sleeping well. And then they go like, oh no, this is not good. I got to do something. And then they start kind of the sleep hygiene. the supplements, the pills, and then they're introducing more effort, have more trouble sleeping. And soon enough, we have the self-sustaining loop that we call insomnia. That's the most common way insomnia happens.
Okay.
But, and this goes to your question, there is another way. There's another way that not sleeping can appear as a threat that has nothing to do with like an initial disruptor. And that is the person who's kind of like just going about their life, minding their own business, and then reads an article that says, oh, if you don't get 8 hours, you're going to get diabetes. And, yeah. And if that
or heart disease,
or heart disease or whatever it is, right? Yeah. If that person believes that, then automatically not sleeping has become a threat, right? And they're like, oh no, if I don't sleep, I get it, et cetera, et cetera. So it can very much start from that point as well. And maybe last point here is that, you know, we could talk longer about this, but a point I want to make is that no medical advice to anyone out there, but I've reviewed this, the literature on this many, many times, including now with AI, by the way. And there just is no evidence that that proves that little sleep or insomnia causes any health issues ever. There just is no proof of that. Whenever you see this headline, like, okay, sleeping less than 6 hours is linked to heart disease. Well, that's all it is. It's just an association. And if we think about it, do we believe that a person who has heart disease or diabetes or dementia, Alzheimer's, sleep just as well as anybody else? That is unlikely. It is highly likely that any type of health issue is going to impact your sleep. And that's why you can find this link. And by the way, the link between health issues and long sleep, sleeping more than 8 hours, or reporting sleeping more than 8 hours, is actually much stronger than the link between health issues and, you know, self-reported short sleep. So again, I think the message here is that there is no evidence that little sleep causes any health issues, and that can be so helpful to learn.
Cool. That was one of the questions I was planning to ask, but thanks for already answering it. Okay. I would like to talk about Set It and Forget It, your first book, and some of the interesting concepts that you introduce in this book. So first, what does the title Set It and Forget It really mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. And for those of you who are tuning in via...
I know what it is, what does it mean, but for our listeners...
Yeah, I'm happy to share it. And I don't know if this is going to be... Yeah, I guess this is going to be shared both as podcast and video.
Yeah, so yeah, for sure.
For those of you who are watching this, they can see that Set It and Forget It is right there behind me, and the other book is right there behind me. But anyway, to be honest with you, the original idea to name the book Set It and Forget It came from a podcast guest I had, whose name is Nick Wignall. And he basically had kind of a CBTI related idea that, you know, you can set this like sleep window. You set it in a sense that you just decide, I'll get up at, you know, 6 a.m. and I'll go to bed at like 10, and then I'll just forget about that. That's just going to be my routine, and then I'm going to forget it. That was actually the original idea behind Set It and Forget It. But the title has evolved now to more like set it as in understand why you have trouble sleeping, understand yourself and the struggle and how you got here, and then see the invitation to just leave all the problem solving and live your life. That's kind of like the gist of Set It and Forget It. Now, for anyone out there who has had somewhat of a struggle with sleep, I think Set It and Forget It is a great book to read, because it's very easy. It's like the chapters are super short. It's breezy. It has nice illustrations. And I will say that my ideas has changed a little bit since I wrote Set It and Forget It. There's some chapters that I would have written different now. Like there's a little bit of a lack of understanding on my part, but it's still a great introductory book. But just if somebody asked me like, what was your main idea when you wrote Set It and Forget It, Daniel, I would say the following. I would say that my idea when I wrote Set It and Forget It was that insomnia is sort of a problem of attention, that when we're sleeping well, it is thanks to us not really paying any attention to sleep. It just happens by itself. And the more preoccupied with attention with sleep we become, the more attention we focus there, the more effort is introduced, and the more trouble we have. And so I saw the solution, if you will, to be sort of like shifting your attention. Understand what happened, but after that, just look in another direction, like see what else is going on with your life. Go fishing, like, you know, enjoy your life, right? And I think Set It and Forget It has helped a lot of people. I think it still does. But there were some concepts that weren't in there that, you know, that came later. So I'll just pause there. But that's kind of like the gist of Set It and Forget It, if you will.
Okay. No, that's a great introduction to this book. And I would like to specifically call out the gas and brake model that you introduced in this book, which I find very, very useful, and which really helped me personally to partly get over my insomnia and my struggle with sleep. And it was kind of a relief to know that usually bodies or the human organism is actually has a natural drive to sleep, and it's actually the hyper arousal that we experience that actually stops it. And then this is kind of the aha moment for me. That's where things started to shift. So maybe you can expand on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the gas and brake model is probably like the most valuable chapter in that book, honestly. And that model that you're referring to, the gas and brake model, still to this day, teach it all the time. It's part of every course I make and every program I create. So I think it's a really nice one. So for anyone who wonders, like, oh, what is this? What is the gas and brake model? Well, essentially, it's a very simple way of understanding how sleep works. And why that is valuable is because of the following. We're often led to believe that sleep is quite complicated. You know, again, going back to sleep hygiene, when we hear that, oh, you need to avoid blue light, you need to eat the right carrots, avoid proteins, like things like that, we can think like, oh, sleep is complicated. I got to get everything correct for me to sleep, which it is in itself makes us anxious about sleep and keeps us from sleeping well. So it's really helpful to understand sleep is very, very simple. Think of a car that has two pedals. It has a gas pedal that makes the car move forward, and it has a brake pedal that makes the car stop. This is essentially the same for true for sleep as well. There's a gas and a brake in the sleep system. And the gas in the sleep system is what's called sleep drive, or sometimes called sleep pressure. And this simply represents how much our body wants to sleep at any given moment in time. And that sleep drive only comes from one source. There's only one thing in the entire universe that can produce sleep drive for us, and that is wakefulness. Simply by, like, the moment we get up in the morning and we you know, continue to be awake, that sleep drive automatically builds in our body. And essentially, the longer we are awake, the more sleep drive we have. And we all know this, that if we've been awake for a long time, eventually we start feeling sleepy, right? That's just an effect of sleep drive building. So that's the gas in our sleep system. Now, we also have a break in our sleep system, and that is hyperarousal. That's like a state of heightened vigilance. And that's there for safety purposes. Like, even if we're really, really sleepy, we're not supposed to sleep if we smell smoke or a fire alarm goes off or something. Like, that's not a safe time to sleep. So we need to have a break in our sleep system. And that's this hyperarousal again. So when we see this, we see that there are essentially four scenarios here. We can be in a place where we have, let's say, no sleep drive and no hyperarousal. This means we haven't been awake for long. Our body is not wanting sleep. We don't have sleep drive, but we're also not concerned or worried or anything else. We're in kind of like a peaceful state of mind. And if we go to bed in this state where there's no sleep drive, no hyperarousal, no gas, no brake, we'll just be resting comfortably. We're not going to sleep because there's no sleep drive, but we're not going to be uncomfortable either. If we are in a state that is the opposite, that we actually have high sleep drive, we haven't slept much, we have a lot of sleep drive, but we're also really hyper aroused, then we're going to have this kind of classical insomnia scenario where we might sleep a little bit, but it's going to be fitful. We're going to sleep a little bit. We're going to wake up. It's going to be like driving a car with both the gas and the brake, you know, pushed in. And then we can have the scenario where we go to bed where we don't have any sleep drive. We kind of go to bed very early and we haven't been awake for long, and we are really hyper aroused. That's going to be very uncomfortable. We're going to be like just being completely awake and very, very alerted. And then we have the final scenario, which is that we do have sleep drive and we don't have any hyperarousal. That's like the place of peaceful sleep that we all want. But the main teaching point here again is that sleep is very complicated. It's not about, like, you know, what color your pillowcase is or how the temperature, all those things don't really matter. And the gas and brake model can really help you see that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people probably don't realize that it's actually based on this very simple. I mean, it is complicated biologically speaking, but it's if we simplify it, you know, the way you simplified it, it actually sheds the light to where we need to actually to what is important. So and based on what you said, if we manage the break aspect, at least, then you know we allow that sleep drive to run its course.
Yeah, okay, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about some of the concepts that you focus on in your second book. This is narrow. And first, let's define narrow. And then why did you decide to write a second book after Set It and Forget It?
Oh, yeah. So after having written Set It and Forget It, I was still pretty much in the mind space that I was teaching a kind of modified version of CBTI, you know, a slightly different, more gentle, more informed version of CBTI. But there were new ideas popping up in my brain. And I, you know, at some point I started having these doubts about like, what am I even doing anymore? Can I even think of myself as somebody that's providing CBTI advice, or is it something different? And the idea that it is something different was starting to become kind of appealing to me, because then I could say like, no, this is not CBTI. This is this new thing. Okay. And this is a new way, a new approach. And that's kind of like inspiring. That's fun. It's like, oh, I can create like a new thing, a new school of thought.
A new moniker.
That appealed to me.
Yeah.
And then, you know, from that idea came the pursuit of like a name. I was like, okay, so if we're going for like a new, you know, school of thinking here and sleep in the sleep world, we got to have it a name. So I was like, kind of actively looking for a name, something to call it. And then just randomly, you know, we were sitting here in our living room. I was sitting there and my wife just said, this thing happened. It's stressing me a little bit, but I'm not attached to the outcome. She said that. I was like, not attached to the outcome. Yeah, that's nice. And I was like, NATTO. I was like, that also could be like a nice like hashtag NATO. Like I'm not, I was like, that's nice. And I'm like, I'm going to call it that. That's because that kind of illustrates the whole point of like the whole framework very nicely. And that also ties into, well, there's another story that I think really, really matters here. And it's also part of the name NATO. After having spoken to, I don't know, hundreds of people who had all left insomnia at that point, one thing was very clear to me, and it was that they all said the same thing. There was not a single person who said, oh yeah, after years of struggling with sleep, I found, you know, Himalayan ashwagandha was the cure. Like that story never happened. The story was always a version of, I stopped caring, or I stopped worrying, or I stopped, like, you know, and that led me to sleeping well. But when people heard like, I stopped caring, that also kind of like didn't sound entirely true, because in a way, we all care about our sleep, right?
Yeah.
It's right. So what is it? And from that pondering, I found that what the person who says I stopped caring really meant is that I stopped caring so much. Or you could say that person became less attached to the outcome. They felt they came to a place where if they slept well or didn't sleep so well, both were kind of acceptable. Both are
so
okay.
I'm okay with both outcomes. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I'm okay with both outcomes. So that's yeah. That plus what my wife said led to NATO becoming kind of the name for the philosophy, if you will.
Okay.
Now, one of the things that had become really clear to me when I was writing This Is NATO was this self-perpetuating aspect of insomnia. And maybe a key chapter or insight or concept that I would like to share from that book is this trouble and desire model. So we can think of it as when we're not struggling with sleep, there's no trouble. And there's also no desire to sleep. Like, sure, we all want to sleep well, but it's not like we're craving sleep, wanting sleep, hoping for it, praying for it, you know, like really, really trying to achieve it. And what I saw was that something can happen to all of us where we have a little trouble sleeping, some disruption in sleep. But if that doesn't lead to any desire to sleep, then we soon enough find ourselves like sleeping well again. But sometimes we have like some trouble sleeping, And then our desire for sleep is increased. And then we start kind of doing things to sleep again. And that increases our trouble sleeping, which increases our desire to sleep and our trouble sleeping. And I call this like a circular problem.
Yes.
And I saw that, I think I sort of had a sense that this was not only true for insomnia, but really so many of these like inner struggles we have around like anxiety and stress in general, but that kind of circular problem idea or concept I presented in This Is Natto, and I think that was kind of a key idea in that book.
And this is very interesting because, you know, this concept of circular problem, I think, is also found in, as you said, general anxieties like phobias, right? Obsessive compulsive behavior. So again, going back to my initial point, do you find, again, some commonalities between like this type of insomnia and anxiety conditions?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, you know, I didn't plan this to be kind of a plug for my next book, but now it naturally becomes that. So actually, today we're recording, what is the day? May 9th, on May 12th, my next book, which is called Principles of Natto, is coming out. And when I wrote This Is Natto, I had this kind of like the sense, this feeling that all these inner struggles, like you said, like phobia, OCD, whatever it is, PTSD, anxiety in general anxiety, they're all somehow related, but I couldn't exactly, you know, formulate how that is. But after like a lot of pondering, thinking, and talking with the community and the other coaches, I now see that the key, like the central concept or the central like substrate, let's say like the building block for any form of inner struggle is what I call tokenization. Tokenization simply means when our brain thinks of something that's inherently harmless as a threat, and that thing becomes like the token. The thing that's harmless, that becomes viewed as a threat. Now, with insomnia, that token is being awake at night. The thing that is actually harmless, being awake at night, has become misinterpreted, mislabeled as a threat, and that leads to a struggle. Yeah. If we then take a specific phobia, let's say arachnophobia, well, it's pretty
fear
obvious.
Fear of spiders. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The token is the spider, right? The thing that is not really harmful has become labeled as a threat for us, right? And the more we try to escape this threat, the more we kind of reinforce that spiders are dangerous, and the more of a loop we have there. General anxiety is interesting because there, the token is the emotion that we call anxiety. Anxiety is actually perfectly harmless to feel, but if we start to think of feeling anxious as a threat, you can see how that becomes a loop, because we all feel a little bit anxious during the day, but if we then think, oh no, I shouldn't feel anxious, this is a threat, guess what? Then anxiety produces more anxiety, which produces more anxiety. And so what I really think now is that the commonality, like the substrate for all these versions of the struggle, is this, that our brain mislabels something harmless as a threat, which, by the way, is a feature and not a bug. Meaning, we can often think that, oh, this is so dumb. Why is the brain doing this? But it's, of course, evolved to do exactly that. When we hear some weird noise in the bushes, our brain is supposed to think, maybe this is a threat. I think this is a threat until, oh no, it's just my friend there. It's not a threat. Like, the brain is supposed to have the ability to temporarily label something as a threat until it sees that it isn't. But you know, the tricky part is that it can get into these loops.
It's kind of self feeding itself. So it's a feedback loop that is self feeding itself. Yeah. Okay. So you also mentioned in This Is Natto a concept, or let's say an activity, which you call befriending wakefulness, which is quite interesting as well. So even in the middle of the night when people wake up, you believe that this can help also overcome sleep struggle. So can you maybe elaborate more on that point as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And yes, the befriending wakefulness concept is a really key one in our teaching around insomnia. And tying it into what I just shared about tokenization and in our previous discussion, insomnia really comes from this notion that not sleeping at night, being awake at night, is like a threat. It's not good. It shouldn't be happening. And that leads to this loop we've talked about. When you see this, you can also see that the change from having trouble sleeping to sleeping well will occur once our brain understands there is no threat. There's nothing to be afraid of. There is nothing to worry about. And doing that, going back to a place where we see no threat, once we started seeing wakefulness as a threat, we call befriending wakefulness. It's kind of like how to meet insomnia, if you will. And there are really three components to befriending wakefulness. Firstly, it is simply intellectually understanding that there is no threat, right? And that often doesn't take so long for people to see, to realize that, okay, there is no real threat. The tricky thing becomes that we often then end up in a place where we're like, okay, intellectually I see that there's no threat, but I'm still scared, I'm still worried. And what we then want to do is like experientially learn that being awake is no threat. And how do we do that? Well, that's like the second layer of befriending wakefulness. That is the sort of exposure therapy aspect of this, which is when we find ourselves not sleeping, when we find ourselves awake in the middle of the night, we do something that makes that more acceptable for us, makes it show the brain that it's okay to be awake. This is not something we need to escape or get away from. Oftentimes when we've had a sleep struggle and we're awake at night, our intuitive reaction becomes like, oh no, what can I do now? Maybe I should like read a boring book, or I should just like lay with my eyes closed and hope to sleep or something like that.
Or start some rituals.
Some ritual, yeah. Listen to soothing podcasts, doing some breathing exercises. Yeah. But that just becomes this this sleep effort, this thing we do to try to sleep, which keeps us awake. So why don't we do the opposite? Why don't we read an interesting book, listen to a podcast that we enjoy, or even watch a Netflix show, or just rest. Anything that you do when you're awake at night that is not an attempt to sleep is befriending wakefulness, making it acceptable for us that we happen to be awake at night. And it's kind of paradoxical, but when our brain sees that there is no threat, everything is fine, even if we're awake at night, then we will sleep easily. And, the third component of this is like the self-kindness aspect of not being hard on ourselves, not criticizing us for ourselves for being awake at night. But one more thing I want to add to that is like the most common misunderstandings and the most common pushback. And a very common pushback is, hey, Daniel, what if I actually pick an interesting book at night to read when I'm awake at night? Won't that just keep me awake longer? Won't that just make me even more awake? And when people say that, I'm always like, now you're into something. Like you found something, you discovered something really, really helpful. When you said, oh my gosh, isn't that going to make me more awake? Then you just described your own fear of wakefulness, which is why you're awake. Even more, an invitation to befriend wakefulness there. That's the kind of the most kind of pushback I get and how I respond to that. Now, the most common misunderstanding of befriending wakefulness is that it is an activity, that is something we do. In reality, it is actually an invitation for non-doing, meaning if I'm awake at night and I'm reading a book, I'm not reading that book to sleep. It's just reading is just an alternative to trying to sleep. So even befriending wakefulness is just an invitation for non-doing. And finally, some people say like, hey, Daniel, like I can't find anything enjoyable or fun to do at night. Well, it might not be fun or enjoyable. And then that's like befriending wakefulness doesn't have to be fun or enjoyable. We can even think like it sucks that I'm awake at night. I don't want to be awake at night. But even if we think it sucks, we can still be accepting of the fact that, well, this is happening and I can't really control it. And so those are kind of the main teaching points I want to convey around befriending wakefulness.
All right. Okay. Daniel, now I have a number of common sleep questions that I think would benefit everyone who's listening. So the first one is like maybe a very common and popular one. Do we really all need 8 hours of sleep? Is this based on science? Or some people are okay with 6, some people are better off with 9. So what is actually the, uh, uh, I mean, what's the best practice here?
Yeah, absolutely. So the short answer to your question is no. We don't all need 8 hours of sleep. Now, a very interesting question is, why do we hear that all the time? Where do we hear that from? Like our friend, like some random blogger? We hear it from the National Institute of Health, and everybody seems to be saying well, you should get around 8 hours of sleep. When you start doing some research, you don't find the answer. It's like you find that number of 8 hours goes back to recommendations that are hundreds of years old, but it doesn't really come from, there's no real source for it. It seems to just have been well, there are 24 hours in the day, we should sleep around a third of that, a third of 24 is 8. Yeah, so let's just say 8. You know, it seems to have some kind of very random origin. Now, if you actually look at studies of how people sleep, you will find the following very, very interesting. If you take 100 people, random people, adults, and ask them, how much do you think you sleep per night? The average reply will be 7 hours. Most people say, I think I sleep 7 hours. When you actually check objectively with EEG, data from the brain, we humans, adult humans, objectively sleep a little bit more than 6 hours, 6 hours, 10 minutes, 6 hours, 20 minutes, something like that. Now that, of course, doesn't mean that most of
people overestimate how much they sleep, or okay.
Yeah, that's right. People who don't have any trouble with sleep overestimate by about 1 hour.
Wow.
Now, if you ask 100 people who have insomnia, who struggle with sleep, they will estimate about an hour less. They will say, I sleep about 5 hours, but objectively sleep okay. about the same, which is very interesting. So again, yeah. Insomnia is really about perspective and kind of narrative. But going back to the fact that most of us actually objectively sleep a bit more than 6 hours, that doesn't mean that most people go to bed 11:40 p.m., fall asleep immediately, and then wake up at 6 a.m., right? It means that we all have sprinkles of wakefulness during the night. It takes us a little bit to transition into sleep, takes us a bit of transition out of sleep, but on average, we actually sleep about six plus hours per night. And I think that's really helpful to know, because oftentimes people think, oh no, if I don't get 8.5 hours of sleep every night, I'm going to get some health issue. Not at all. It's
perfect. And this actually can cause insomnia in itself. Yeah.
Classic case of how it's all mindset. But you're also illustrating how a lot of people in, let's say, media, in healthcare, in the sleep sciences, sleep physicians, sleep doctors, sleep advocates, etc., they seem to think that they're just doing the world a favor by saying, make sure you get enough sleep. If you don't sleep enough, this is going to happen. They think that there's no downside to this message, but there is a great downside to this message, which is that so many people get performance anxiety and insomnia from that message. So hopefully, talks like this talk will help change the narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's move to the next question. What is your best advice for people who have no problem sleeping when they go to bed, but wake up in the middle of the night or a bit too early in the morning and then have trouble falling back asleep? And this is also a classic, I think, scenario.
Yeah, very common. I've gotten this question many times. And I have three-step approach to meet this situation. And this is for anyone who has more of this sleep maintenance insomnia situation where I don't have trouble falling asleep. I just wake up in the middle of the night and then I don't fall back asleep. I would say step number one is see the invitation to not know the time. What a lot of people say is I don't know, I have no problem falling asleep, but then I wake up and it's 2 a.m. And then I stress out and I'm thinking about that. But a lot of that comes from you doing the sleep math of checking the time and being oh no, I didn't sleep enough. Oh no, I only had this much time to get back. And if you think about it, when did you ever wake up in the middle of the night, check the time, and then feel oh, how nice that is this time. That's perfect. Now I'm going to fall. It always leads to some kind of worry or sleep math. So generally speaking, really helpful to just not know the time. Keep things fuzzy. Don't know the time. That's number one. Number two is to accept reality. And the reality is that if you wake up, if you find yourself kind of wide awake in the middle of the night, well, you are awake now. And if you try to like argue with that, if you try to like change reality and force yourself to fall back asleep as quickly as possible, you know, you're never going to win in kind of an argument with reality. You're just going to have more struggle, right? So just accept the fact that you're awake, and then befriending wakefulness is like number three there. Instead of trying to force yourself to sleep, see the invitation to just do something nice for yourself. And as paradoxical as it sounds, this actually leads to us falling back asleep easier.
Yeah. One thing that worked for me is as you said, I read a book, and, you know, I mean, more often than not, sleep comes back after half an hour or an hour. And then, yeah. And I read something that I enjoy. Exactly. Yeah.
And for those in the audience here who guess this, you know, a couple of people are going to be like, Iman, tell me which book. I'm going to buy the exact same book and I'm going to read it. No. It wasn't the book that made Iman fall back asleep. It was just the fact that you were no longer trying to sleep. You're just doing something you liked, and then sleep falls naturally.
Correct. All right. Next one. How do you view the fear around blue light and screens at night? You know, also in the media, we always hear, you know, don't use laptops, don't use the phone close to your bed, etc. Is there like actual science that says that blue light will actually disrupt the sleep? Or in general, does it intervene with melatonin production and all these biological, components that gets released when someone is sleeping?
Yeah, I've not found any evidence that blue light is particularly disruptive to sleep, or that's different from actually any other wavelength, or definitely not that it causes insomnia. Not at all. And again, if we think about people who have no trouble sleeping, many of people who have no trouble sleeping break every sleep hygiene rule that there is, including like myself. Like every night I go to bed and me and my wife watch some Netflix show or some TV show on a laptop that's literally like this close to my face, which is flooded with like a backlit screen light, and I have no problem sleeping whatsoever, right? So I think, in fact, it is when we start thinking like, oh no, I need to sleep better, so I need to stop, I need to block blue light, I need to do these things to sleep better. That's when we have trouble. So yeah, I don't think there's any evidence.
So that's simply just another ritual that is backfiring. Yeah.
I call that a myth. Yeah.
A myth. Okay. Okay. What do you think about sleep trackers and, you know, those wearables now, and people like measure every night how much they slept and how much was REM sleep, etc. I mean, what about that?
yeah, people. I think probably people who have tuned into this episode can guess what I'm gonna say, and that is that for anyone who's like struggling with sleep, not sleeping well, or not feeling like you're not getting enough sleep or good quality sleep, tracking it is tricky. It's more likely just gonna lead to more stress, less sleep, and feeling less refreshed. Again, because of this effortless nature of sleep, it thrives on nothing, you know. And what I want to add to that is, some people ask like, well, don't we need this amount of REM sleep or deep sleep or slow wave sleep to feel refreshed? And when I was working as a sleep doctor, I used to read sleep studies, which is like, you know, I used to interpret this raw data from EEG, right? And what was so interesting was that you could have the most beautiful sleep architecture, like the textbook sleep, you know, fast sleep onset, like big chunks of deep sleep in the beginning, you know, cycles of REM, and everything was just perfect. And then you like meet the person like, how did you sleep that night? And they're like, awful, I slept terrible. And the complete opposite. You had this typically elderly person who had like 5 hours of fragmented sleep, like no REM sleep, no deep sleep. And you're like, how did you sleep? And they're like, I slept great. That always stays with me, because it shows that like our experience of sleep, it has nothing to do with those REM percentages or, you know, cycles or anything like that. It is much more to do with, you know, how we perceive sleep and how we think about sleep and how we think about our day. You know, like we can just to sneak in one more little example of that is like, or one little thought here, is that a lot of people have the idea that if I just sleep more in general, I will feel more refreshed. But that often is not true. And if we think about, you know, so far we've talked about insomnia, we talked about anxiety, phobias, and all these things are kind of mind states where we are hyper aroused, where we're kind of like scared, we're threatened, we're like, you know, hyper vigilant, right? But the polarity of that is when we're hypo-aroused, right? When we are depressed, when we're sad. And when we humans feel like depressed and sad, we tend to sleep a lot. You know, we sleep like, you know, 9-10 hours, you know, but do we feel refreshed? No, we feel tired and we don't feel well, right? So just another illustration of how like sleep is not the main determinant of how we feel during the day. And that's so helpful to know, because then that leads us to less pressure and easier sleep.
That's right. Next question. What's your opinion about sleep medication? Can they play a role in recovery, or they're usually part of the problem?
Yeah, that's a nice question, and one that you know, takes a few minutes to answer in a meaningful way. But I would say this, that we said already that sleep really is effortless. Like, it happens by itself when we're not trying to sleep, right? And a common, let's say, pushback to that is a person who says, well, I don't think that's true, Daniel, because when I take my Ambien or Lesta or Trazodone or Seroquel or whatever it is, whenever I take the sleeping medication, I always fall asleep right after. So that, to me, the person making this case is saying, like, well, that shows you that sometimes sleep can be produced, like you can do something to sleep. And I say that's actually not true, because from just a physiological, biological standpoint, sleep cannot be chemically induced. That's actually impossible. It cannot happen. Yes, we can have anesthesia where we are not asleep. We're actually unconscious. Yes, there are medications and drugs that can render us unconscious, but there's no medication that can make us sleep. If, you know, a common, you know, proof of this is somebody who's like really desperate to sleep, really anxious, and then they take like 3 times their amount of sleep medication, still don't sleep, which shows us that if we're worried, anxious, doesn't matter how much sleep medication we take, we will not sleep. But that has not answered the question of this person who says, well, when I take it, I always fall asleep. So what's going on there? That phenomenon is something we call delegation. When we take a pill, a sleeping pill, 2 things are happening. Yes, there are some chemicals that are dispersed in our body, true. But the other thing is that we are aware of taking a pill. And if we think when we take the pill that, oh, okay, this pill is going to take care of my sleep, great. Now I don't have to do anything to sleep.
So placebo effect?
Essentially, yes. Meaning...
Okay. Partly, I mean, at least partly.
I'll put it this way. We call it delegation because what yep. really works is to like delegate the presumed work needed. So when we think, now I don't have to do anything further to sleep, guess what? We are now effortless. This is effortlessness. We're not trying to sleep anymore. And that's the magic. That's what leads us to sleep. Now, when we say the placebo effect, you know, it's a little mystical. Because the placebo effect is essentially saying, like, if you believe in a sleeping pill, it will make you sleep. But it doesn't answer how. So the concept of delegation, I think, is actually more clear, because it shows that it's like the act of thinking, I don't have to do anything, I've delegated work, that's the magic. Now, does that mean that, you know, we shouldn't take sleeping pills because they actually don't make us sleep? I'm not an advocate for or against. Like, my thinking is kind of very neutral here. And that's because, you know, sleeping medications are like, they are generally speaking very safe. They've been around for years. And if somebody's taking a sleeping pill and they sleep well and they don't have any conflict around it, then why stop? I'm like, you know, if you're living your life, you're sleeping well, there's no problem. But I would say this, that they're definitely not like the solution to insomnia. Like, sleeping pills are not going to make you sleep, you know? So I think that the solution to insomnia is really education and understanding. But if somebody takes a sleeping pill or not, like, either way,
it's a case by it can be a case by case as well, right?
Yeah, totally.
For some people, it may help maybe at one point, but then you always advocate to, I mean, sleep without them, because it's possible.
Yeah. I would say, I think when I, going back to set it and forget it, when I wrote Set It and Forget It, my mindset was a little different. My mindset then was very much like, well, if you take a sleeping pill and you sleep well, you're going to think that the sleeping pill did that. And you're going to kind of like give away like confidence in yourself. You're not going to believe in yourself anymore. But nowadays, I think more like, well, anything that you feel is helpful for yourself right now feels like self-care and is like what you want to do for yourself now. Go ahead and do that, right? So it's a little bit, yeah, you can see this is a little bit more of a gray area, but...
Yeah, just an add-on question to this. Could it be that some of those sleep medication actually inhibit like maybe some part of the brain that worries so that maybe the break maybe is then released and sleep can happen? Maybe this could be also next, because most of them are very... By the way, I noticed that a lot of those sleep medication are common with anxiety medication. Like they are like almost the same. So could that be also an explanation why they may work and maybe may not work after some time because we get accustomed to them?
Yeah. It's a very nice question. And my answer to that would be all that sleeping, the chemicals in a sleeping pill or in an anti-anxiety pill as well, are all actually simply sedating. Like whether it is like a, you know, antidepressant, antipsychotic, benzodiazepine, or that, all they really do is produce some level of sedation, right? Just like alcohol or maybe cannabis or anything that is sedating can, you know, no, let me rephrase that. Let's just say with they're all just simply sedating. And sedation and like peace of mind or calm are actually very different things, you know? Because like...
Understanding, when you say sedating, it means like numbing some parts of the brain? This is what you mean? So make it less active?
Yeah.
Okay, okay.
They do suppress you know, neuronal activity at some level. That's true. But there is a kind of a higher order of things, meaning if we're worried and we take, let's say, like some ancillary pill, we can start feeling like the sedating effect affecting us. And if we then think, oh, how nice, I'm starting to become sedated, I don't do anything further, yes, then we can fall asleep. But again, it's the thought that matters. If in the exact same scenario, if we kind of worry, we take a sedating pill and we're starting to feel sedated and we go like, oh my gosh, I'm feeling sedated. I hope this works. Will this make me sleep? This better make me sleep. It leads in the other direction, right? So to me, it illustrates like the primacy of thought. Like the thought, the narrative interpretation is always what matters the most. And now like final point here is like, you're essentially asking like, but couldn't it be that like the chemicals within a pill to somehow kind of disables our safety system, kind of disables the brake, disables
hypervigilance. Yeah.
Yeah. Disables hypervigilance.
Yeah.
And my answer to that would be like, if you can imagine that you are so inebriated, like you're like incredibly drunk, right? So impacted by alcohol that you can't even formulate a coherent thought. Yeah. Your safety system is inactive. So, and that can make you sleep. True. But that's not really what happens when we take a pill, right? So I'll answer it that way.
All right, cool. No, this is cool. Final question. Should people worry about sleep debt, this concept that, you know, we hear about in the media, you know, which is basically catching up on missed sleep in the past? I don't know what you think about this.
No, my answer to that is not at all. There's nothing to worry about there. That's another myth, actually.
It's a myth, okay.
Yeah, it is a myth. Meaning sleep pressure, sleep drive, it's true. It's true that the longer we stay awake, the more like our body wants to sleep and that kind of sleep pressure builds up. But if we realize that, you know, we've been like missing sleep for years, whether it is for insomnia or whether it is because we have small kids or we were like an entrepreneur who was like really into our business and like for, we say like, for 5 years, I think I slept 1 hour less than I should every night. I mean, it's like, oh my gosh, I have like 365 times five, like I have 1,000 hours of sleep debt. And how am I going to repay all the sleep debt? No, that's not a real thing. It doesn't accumulate like that. It's sort of like if you have been eating 100 calories less than was like ideal for you for 10 years, you're probably going to be really lean and skinny, but you're going to function pretty well anyway, right? And it's not like you now have to eat like thousands of calories extra every day. No, it's like your body can cope with that. So nobody needs to worry about sleep that. And if you've for any reason been sleep deprived, it takes, I would say, the matter of days or weeks and your sleep debt, quote unquote sleep debt is like paid.
Repaid. Okay. All right. Cool. Now let's talk a little bit about your projects. First of all, I'd like to know, who is Ellie?
Yes. Yeah. For anyone out there who's wondering, Ellie is our AI, like ChatGPT powered bot that is answering questions in our app, which is called Bedtime, spelled with a Y, BEDTYME, which is available on the App Store for anyone interested. And so Bedtime really has like a educational curriculum, which I think is key. But then we also have Ellie there who can answer questions for you. And it was my lead developer, Hang, he told me like a year and a half ago or something about like, you know, ChatGPT. Everybody had that ChatGPT moment, like, this is so cool. And he was like, we should develop a bot. And we did. So I already had a quite big like question and answer bank. And I like imported that into ChatGPT and then built Ellie. And yeah, the first time I used Ellie, it was like spooky. I'm sure many had that moment of like, I answer questions like, oh my gosh, Ellie answers just like I did. Like, this is like me in a bot form. This is insane. But yeah, that's Ellie. And and I know from reviewing kind of like de-identified logs, as well as from talking to students, that people actually have these like intimate conversations with Ellie and thanks Ellie and says, thanks so much. And like, this was so helpful. And it's very interesting. But I think on one hand, like leaving insomnia, for many people, it helps to actually speak to another human to get that kind of like, you know, the empathy and just knowing that somebody else has gone through that. But AI definitely has a role to play here too. And Ellie has been really helpful.
Yeah, perfect. I mean, it allows, I guess, people to access anytime, anywhere, a sleep coach who's trained on your curriculum and your courses, correct? So basically, you've used a ChatGPT core algorithm, and then you guys have trained it on the materials that you teach, correct?
Yeah, exactly right.
Okay, very, very interesting. So what are other features of the Bedtime app? In addition to Ellie, so does it allow, for example, for like watching videos as well, and or it's this is like the online platform, the website?
Yeah, we have our YouTube channel, the Sleep for School, where we have like tons of educational videos, and the app itself is actually not very feature rich, and that's by design, because you know when we're struggling with insomnia, we actually want to understand that there's, you know, all we want is like education and understanding and getting our questions answered. So really, it is that curriculum where like every day you're dripped like an educational module, like, you know, to read. And it takes probably just like, you know, 5-10 minutes a day to read that educational module. And then there's a little bit of a diary asking you kind of how you felt and how things are going for you. And then there's like the Ellie to answer your questions. And of course, if you want to have a conversation with a real human coach, there's a plan for that too, where you get paired with a coach who has gone through insomnia as well.
All right. Okay. All right. Daniel, for someone listening who's been battling insomnia for months or years, what is one easy and feasible action you advise them to start doing today to sleep better, to maybe start going on the right path?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I'd say, again, check out all our free resources on YouTube. I think that's great. But if somebody said like, hey, Daniel, what can I do like today to kind of start my journey towards sleeping easier? I would say, number one, see this invitation to no longer track your sleep. Like just... like go to bed when you feel like going to bed, maybe set an alarm just to get up at a certain point, but then kind of see the intention, not track it, number one. Number two, I would say see the invitation to apart from checking out our nice free resources, see the invitation to not Google and research and go on Reddit or Facebook. Just like see what happens when you're no longer trying to problem solve. And number three, see the invitation to, if you have been that person who tells everyone about your sleep, like asks, you know, your random Uber driver and your friend, like, and your family members start asking you, like, how do you sleep? See the invitation to be like, I'm not going to talk to anybody about sleep. You know, I'm just going to leave that alone. And those are kind of three things that can be really powerful as like the kind of initial step towards where you want.
Okay. Very helpful. And, you know, to close on that, where can people learn more about your work, your books, and the programs that you offer?
Yeah, I would say definitely just go to YouTube and search for The Sleep Coach School. And that's a great starting point. There are interviews with people who've had insomnia, there are educational videos too. And from there, you can find our website, you can find my books and everything. But the YouTube channel is a great place to start.
Okay. And personally, I highly recommend your two books that I have read. For me, I mean, I like reading. And I started my journey there, and it was very helpful for me. And then I watched a few of your videos as well in the past, but the books were kind of really the what helped me shift from my old ways of thinking about sleep to my new ways of thinking about sleep. And then I learned how not to care too much about the outcome. So highly recommended, Set It and Forget It, and This Is Naro as well. Daniel, any final words before we close this off?
No, I'll just say, if anyone out there just found this kind of nice and inspiring and an interesting episode, that's wonderful. If there's anyone in the audience who's thinking, this sounds great, but I think I'm a hopeless case, I think my case is different than anybody else's, I don't know if there's any path for me, just know that there is. Anyone out there who's willing to just do a little bit of learning, you can find your way to where you want to be, peaceful sleep and peace of mind. So please know that.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Daniel. It was a very interesting and educational episode today.
Anytime. Super nice to be here.
Cool. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.